I am Joel Huberman, and I am going to try to substitute for Jack Wozniak. In any case, I am pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Rick Van Wickler. Thanks to the Verney Foundation for generously sponsoring today's event. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. Our speaker today is Richard, or Rick, Van Wickler. Rick Van Wickler has been the superintendent of the Cheshire County Department of Corrections since June of 1993. His career in corrections began in 1987 at the Merrimack County, New Hampshire Department of Corrections. Superintendent Van Wickler was appointed by the Cheshire County Board of Commissioners in 1993 to assume responsibility for the Cheshire County Jail, which at that time faced significant litigation in federal court and also needed some revitalization in terms of training, structure, and professionalism. Superintendent Van Wickler has extensive background in training and management, which led to his founding of Chameleon Consulting of New England in the year 2001. He has provided numerous presentations on the prevention and management of aggressive human behavior in many jurisdictions of New Hampshire. His knowledge of corrections has been tremendously enhanced by his attendance at the National Institute of Corrections in Colorado, and his experience as an adjunct faculty instructor in justice studies for Keene State College and the New Hampshire Community Technical College. And now let us welcome Rick Van Wickler to the podium.
Before I get started with my presentation, there are a couple of people I'd like to thank as well. Jose, for sure, thank you so much for sharing your wonderful gift with us. I'd like to thank Joel, of course, and Mary Kaplan, along with the entire Monadnock Lyceum Committee, for the honor to be present with you here this morning. John Goodhue, I want to thank you for introducing me to Joel. And I also want to thank you for all the work that you've done as a volunteer at the Department of Corrections for so many years. You truly have touched and changed a lot of lives. Jack Wozniak, I thank you for nothing. For all of you that are here this morning or listening by podcast, sharing your time with me is deeply appreciated by both myself and my wife, who's here this morning, Sarah. We're grateful and humbled to have the opportunity to be a participant in this wonderful historic event at the Monadnock Lyceum. I remember when I was a child, having been born and raised in the United States Air Force, I would look out at the fighter jets doing all kinds of fantastic maneuvers. The thrusters taking off and landing. These were men and women that were willing to sacrifice everything, including their life, for freedom and justice for all. To this day, the sight and the sound of jet thrusters, to me, is the sound of the protection of freedom. And I certainly realize that's not the case for everybody. Many years later, I would enlist in the Army. When I was in the Army, part of my training was to learn about the United States flag and American traditions. I came to understand that the United States flag was a living, breathing symbol, and it was drafted by our founders, sewn together by patriots who had a dream for a better life. The most prestigious place on the battlefield in our founding years was that of the flag bearer, a person who did not have a weapon necessarily, or if they did, it was slung over their back. Their purpose was to pick up that American flag and be at the forward edge of the battle area. If they were shot or wounded, which happened often, the next person would sling their weapon and pick up that flag and run it into battle until he too would drop. That flag led people into battle. It helped identify where the battlefront was amongst the smoke and the confusion. The flag and the idea of freedom were never to be captured. Rather than allow capture, the flag would be torn into little tiny pieces, and they would distribute it amongst themselves so that when they got captured, they could look at this piece of flag and keep hope for freedom and justice alive. It was to inspire those who were losing hope. The purpose of all of that was that anyone from anywhere could come to this country and not fear persecution, that the meek would be protected, that differing opinions would be respected and revered, with the closing line in our pledge to that flag and our cause was "and justice for all." The original intent of our founding was to be a mosaic as a nation, not a melting pot. This great history inspired me as it had so many others. I was then, and I always will be, willing to make that ultimate sacrifice to preserve the ideals of freedom and our way of life. I think that is in large part why I dedicated my entire life to public service. We weren't perfect then as a nation, and we're not perfect now, but we are resilient. So this morning, I want to talk to you about why I think American corrections isn't. My life's path led me to the criminal justice system 38 years ago. 32 years ago, it began right here in New Hampshire. And I strongly submit to you today, as a public servant for over three decades, that significant reform is necessary, not only in our criminal justice system, but in our societal and individual thinking as well, if we are to persevere as an undivided nation that hails to be indivisible with liberty and justice for all. Corrections has one principal mission: public safety. The purpose of corrections is twofold. First is detention, to hold people that can't make bail, to make sure that they don't flee so that they're available for court. And their second primary function is that of punishment. American punishment. American punishment in the United States is best defined by the American Correctional Association, who says that inmates are not in jail to be punished. Inmates are in jail as punishment. Corrections, then, have a duty to provide for the care, the custody, and the management of adult offenders while they are incarcerated. And one of our biggest challenges today in this country is addiction and the misuse of both legal and illicit drugs. Drug users and addicts are not necessarily a risk to public safety, nor are they a risk of flight. Whether or not to punish drug use behavior is the current change in America's thinking, and rightfully so. An awakening for those of us that are in the criminal justice system and our political representation is not only possible, but now it's necessary if we have any hope to make a positive difference in our approach on addressing the challenge of managing drug misuse and addiction. Facts matter. Science matters. Currently in the United States, we have 2.1 million people behind bars. We have 6.6 million people in our correctional system. Corrections was originally intended to be a detention facility for criminals with an effort towards rehabilitation. But all branches of the criminal justice system in the United States have experienced a very fast expansion of mission creep. Our ever-changing society continues to reshape the level of demand that our response has. Today, corrections is tasked with being a detention center. We're a mental health institution. We are a hospital in the community. By federal law, under certain circumstances, we are a school. Sadly, at times, we are even a nursing home. The largest mental health facility in every community across the nation is your local jail. In modern corrections, we've come to know five different categories of offender. The first category is that of a career criminal. A career criminal is an individual who probably got in trouble as a juvenile, graduated to misdemeanor time, and then on to felony time. Career criminals are people who have a propensity for the criminal thought process and are individuals who have spent more time incarcerated than they have at liberty in the community. But they're not the largest category of offender. We have situational offenders, which are people who got up in the morning without the intent to harm or hurt anybody, but a particular situation rose to the level where they violated the law and now they are a criminal. The last thing in the world they ever could have imagined happening. And an example of that would be a motor vehicle accident where it is then determined that somebody died as a result of negligent homicide. There are cases across this country where people are significantly abused, and at some point, the person who's being abused snaps and turns on the perpetrator, which violates a crime and makes them a criminal of a very serious offense. We have sex offenders. We have different categories of sex offenders. We have prostitution. We have incest. We have rape. We have people who view child pornography on the internet. We have mentally ill offenders. 32% of the people in our institution and across the nation, those statistics are the same, 32% are diagnosed with a mental illness. And the majority of that population is dual diagnosed, meaning that not only do they have a mental illness, but they also have a substance use disorder. And the final category are drug users. Using drugs is a crime in the United States. And so we have a lot of those people who are incarcerated in this country, not for committing a violent crime, but for altering their consciousness in a way that is unacceptable to the rest of us. Several weeks ago, I was preparing to do a presentation, and at that particular time, we had 160 inmates. We can hold up to 230. And I said to my classification director, I said, I want you to take a look at the number of inmates that we have, and I want you to look at each of their individual classifications. I want you to tell me, back out of that number, do the calculus, back out the number of people that are mentally ill from that 160 number. And then I want you to back out the number of people who committed their crime in order to get drugs out of that number. And then I want you to back out how many people are here for using drugs. And of 160 inmates, we were left with 13. In a community of 73,000 people, that's Cheshire County. What's interesting about that fact is that if we say that we have 13 people incarcerated per 73,000 in our community, it puts us in line with the rest of the free world in terms of the incarceration ratio. We have now gone from not being the country who has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the inmates, but now we've become a country that falls in line with the rest of the free world that does not over-incarcerate and have a reasonable ratio per 100,000. Part of my job is to be a business manager for our constituents. The cost of corrections for our county and Cheshire County is over $38,000 a year per inmate. Now that's less than some states, it's more than other states. That number is trending with the national average. I've often pondered in my office what sort of treatment program or addiction for addiction or mental health could $38,000 a year buy somebody? Based on our current collective thinking, what good does 1 year in jail for that crime do, either specifically to the person or generally to the population? The fact is, it doesn't do society much good at all, but it will spend almost $39,000. The business of corrections demands professional personnel with longevity, something that we can't get in this country. All of you who have special skill sets and careers and things that you've done in your lifetime know that experience for anything counts. Nationally, correctional officers' average length of stay on the job is 1.5 years. 72% of the people in corrections have less than 5 years on the job. What we need from our primary personnel is often not available as they are not with us long enough. They can't learn the job. And worse yet, they're not taught the job correctly in the first place. Because by default, we are the component of the criminal justice agency that oftentimes, not always, that oftentimes ends up with people who are technically oriented and not conceptually oriented. In layman's terms, they really don't know what they're doing. Why do people leave? Why won't they stay in this profession? It is a thankless profession. Of the three components of the criminal justice system, police, courts, and corrections, you could go home this afternoon or tonight and turn on your television and you will find a show that glorifies police work. You will find a show that glorifies court work. But every single time you see a correctional professional depicted, they're unprofessional. They're taking advantage of somebody. They have no administrative authority or control. They're unfit. And it is simply not the truth. We are compensated far less than the other two components. This is not the career that you could work and hope to eventually buy a house, have children, and live the American dream. It is not. So truly, what is society's realistic expectation of our success, given that our current multifaceted mission oftentimes lacks support? We struggle every day with trying to balance mission creep and expectation versus funding. I mentioned mission creep earlier as a significant challenge for modern law enforcement. I submit this to you. No component of the criminal justice system was ever intended to be in the drug rehabilitation business. And yet, that net, which is thrown over our society, grows larger and larger every day and has become our mission. Facts matter. Science matters. Law enforcement assisted diversion, or LEAD, is a popular program growing nationally where addicts who surrender to the police are referred to treatment without fear of conviction. Well, I'm all for avoiding prison for an addiction. I just do not subscribe to addiction management being the responsibility of first responders, the police, or corrections. It was never in our mission. Well, for now, thank you. Well, for now, it is in our mission description. That's our mandate from you, from our leaders. And so now, at our jail, we provide medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, to addicted persons while they are incarcerated in hopes that they will continue this treatment when they're released and not utilize illegal substances, or worse, use those illegal substances and die. And we should do that. It's the right thing to do based on our current system and our current county's increased desire for harm reduction practice. But I say again, why should an addict have to surrender to a fire department or a police agency for help? A lot of communities are advocating that today. Why does one have to get arrested in our country in order to get treatment? The problem with our criminal justice system and our public policy is that we think that we can control behavior. Our academies have recruits believing and expecting that they control behavior in the community. We need to understand that this is not possible. We in law enforcement control nothing, but we can manage anything. For those of you that know, our jail has notoriety for being really special about how it treats offenders, how we lack litigation, how people aren't getting hurt or abused. Well, we can't handpick our offenders. They're the same for us as they are for everybody else. The difference is in our approach. And when the American Correctional Society said our responsibility is care, custody, and control, I gave out a very strong directive to our personnel that said your job has nothing to do with control. Your job is care, custody, and management. And once we change control to management, everything changes. We shouldn't forget the 9 principles of Sir Robert Peel, the founder of modern policing, from his proposal in the 1800s. But especially his last principle, which is, and I quote, to recognize always that the test of police efficiency is the absence of crime and disorder and not the visible evidence of police action in dealing with them, end quote. Peel knew that police action did not equal police efficiency. Increased policing does not help this problem of drug use. Imagine if our system of crime control were referred to as crime management. Imagine if our drug control policy were referred to as a drug management policy. It changes the entire dynamic. The word control suggests to me that one can turn this off or make it stop. That's the true action of the word control. The word control suggests that until we get to zero, we can't stop what we're doing, no matter how ineffective it is, because, well, we think we're in control. Imagine if we replaced the term fight drug addiction with understand drug addiction. How would that reshape our national response? As individuals, when we try to solve this problem, we must understand that our frame of reference that we have is going to be very different than that of an addict. We cannot be critical of addiction when we then go home to a home, a family, a paycheck, a future, hope, and certainly having to endure only minimal physical or emotional pain. A person who has none of those things, or anyone who suffers from physical or emotional pain, will seek to ease that pain, especially if there's no hope for a future. Our dosage remedy to ease our physical or emotional pain will be proportionate to our perceived suffering. That bears repeating. Our dosage remedy to ease our physical or emotional pain will be proportionate to our perceived suffering. We all alter our consciousness in different ways. That's the thing. Some are runners, some do yoga, others bicycle. I smoke cigars, way too many cigars. We all have vices or things that we do that allows us to sit down and alter our consciousness. Unfortunately, some people turn to alcohol and some to drugs. So how big is the issue of illegal drug use? Do we think that we know? We established that there's 2.1 million people behind bars, with another 6.6 million in the correctional system, the largest offender population of any nation on earth, and yet we're not the most violent one. Our correctional system is beginning to question, of these millions of incarcerated citizens, who really needs to be in jail? If incarceration is the answer, well then, facts and science should matter. I hope you hear this, if you hear nothing else this morning. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, in 2017, 30.5 million people aged 12 or older used an illicit drug in the last 30 days. 30.5 million. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health estimates that in 2016, over 130 million people in the United States, age 12 and older, tried an illegal drug at some point in their lifetime. That's one-third of our entire nation has engaged in illegal drug activity at least once. Currently, we've built a correctional system that we can't afford, and yet we have only 2.1 million people of potentially another 31 million people to find and incarcerate at just under $39,000 a year with no lasting positive effect of that incarceration. We've locked up millions of nonviolent people that will have enormous opportunity costs and societal costs that will have long-lasting negative effects on our nation as well as those individuals. Drug use has three categories: use, misuse, and addiction, just like alcohol does. We all know somebody that drinks. We all know somebody that drinks probably more than we should. And we all know somebody that drinks to the point of being an alcoholic. Let me be the messenger today to share with you that not everyone who uses heroin, cocaine, marijuana, or any other illicit drug is an addict. Many are functional recreational users. And like many of you, I was a shocked non-believer until research revealed the facts. Dr. Carl Hart is the head of behavioral neuroscience at Columbia University. His general area of research is behavioral and neuropharmacological effects of psychoactive drugs in humans. Dr. Hart said science should be driving our drug policies, even if it makes us uncomfortable. I joined others years ago saying that drug misuse and addiction was a health problem and not a crime problem. There's a hint of me saying that today. However, Dr. Hart encouraged me a few years ago. He said, please don't say that drug use is a health problem. He pointed out that many Americans, up to 31 million of them, are regular recreational users, and it presents no remarkable health problems for most of them. Now, please note here that neither Dr. Hart nor I encourage the use of any kind of drug. That isn't the point. Enter on the scene of the illegal market fentanyl and the massive unintentional deaths that are associated with that. In the last 12 months, the Cheshire County Jail has lost to overdose deaths 28 recidivists after they're released from custody. The year before that, almost as many. These are people in our community who we have come to know and were on the criminal justice merry-go-round because of their misuse, who are no longer with us due to fentanyl overdose. They're people that we have come to know. Their passing affected us. This recidivism, this inability to fix people, is grueling for us in the criminal justice system. I've been present for a lot of locker room talk about people saying, first responders saying, how many times do we have to Narcan this particular individual? We've given him Narcan 6 times. We keep bringing him back. Why do we need to keep doing this? People in our jail are saying people come in and they go out and they come in and they go to drug court and they come in and they go out to drug court again. Why do we have to keep doing this? Imagine the frustration. The answer to the locker room talk is we do the best we can always and accept the result. We don't have the opportunity to pick and choose when or who or why. It is not our responsibility to put morals on anybody else. It is our responsibility as public servants to help people. The people that we're trying to rehab, the people that we're trying to save could be your family. It could be mine. But it's frustrating. Our community has lost educators and other professionals to the overdose phenomenon. People who were never incarcerated, ever arrested, never had a record. They certainly couldn't seek treatment. That would require an unfathomable personal disclosure in our society and would certainly label them with a stigmatization that is more harmful than good. When these types of death in large numbers occur in communities of color, it's a crime wave. But now that we all know someone who knows someone of all socioeconomic backgrounds who have succumbed to this tragedy, it has become an epidemic. Our white privilege in New Hampshire joins the nation in redefining the problem as it creeps into our neighborhood. It's not a crime wave anymore. Now it's an epidemic. I've had several opportunities to give presentations on drug policy reform. People often approach me afterwards and they say, my daughter died of an overdose. And when I hear this, I say to them, your daughter was not a criminal. These words often result in the parents breaking down emotionally. They do so because they've lived with the societal stigmatization of addiction that was assigned to their child, a label unworthy of the vibrant young life that they brought into this world and loved so dearly. Indicating to these parents that their child was not a criminal seemed to be a vindication for which they are all worthy. So how did this happen, and what can we do about it? I believe that it happened because we all have a confirmation bias. We hold fast to our current beliefs about any issue, and we work very hard to defend those beliefs. We do that because it's uncomfortable for us to be wrong. We will accept only points that support our view rather than challenge our view and strengthen it with the truth and science. We need to challenge our beliefs with facts, the truth, and science, if we're to become a better, more humane society. I believe that we're governed by default pictures that pop up in our mind that were created by propaganda or false narratives to purposely create these default pictures in our mind when we hear of certain topics. An example of this is when I invited a person who was running for the United States Senate He wanted to know more about the effects of the opioid crisis in our community, and I invited him to the jail so he could see it firsthand. I brought him into the day room where there were 18 or so young women, half of whom were mothers, and more than 80% of them were victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. And I asked a group of women with this senatorial candidate there, who among you are addicted to opioids? And all of them raised their hands. My guest gasped out loud, unavoidably. As his eyes teared, he looked at me and he said, "These could be my daughters. It isn't what I imagined," he said. And that's because our default picture of an addict is of a person with a needle protruding from their arm, lying next to a toilet in a gas station. Our default picture is erroneous by a huge measure. Our institutional thinking is different than our individual thinking. We have a need, it seems, for interpreters in our life, people to tell us how to think and how to feel about certain topics. Even after our nation's leader speaks, whoever that is at the particular time, we have to have a selected party member tell us what they said after that and how well they did, as if we cannot make that decision for ourselves. Many people need Rush Limbaugh or Rachel Maddow to explain to them what is happening, and they will hold fast to that mental programming. These interpreters can be harmful and careless and negatively impact our individual thinking. We're becoming a society where we cannot disagree with one another and still like one another. That ignorance will separate and destroy us. So what can we do? We can seek to establish policy on how to remedy addiction. When we seek to establish a policy on how to remedy addiction and we don't have an addict or a former addict at the table, we're doing it wrong. Why? Because their frame of reference is different than ours. Our solution is not necessarily the best solution. We should educate ourselves. We should learn about the history of addiction in America, how we got here. How can we get out of it? We should believe only the facts. We should challenge what we hear. Is it really true? Because facts matter and science matters. Let's embrace managing the problem and do away with thinking that we can control things, because we can't. An attempt to control is a futile exercise in ignorance. Management is about learning about harm reduction programs. It's about looking at other communities and countries that have had success in their struggle with this issue. Management is having an honest and open discussion with addicts and not forcing our morals upon them. Understand that increased prohibition has a ballooning effect and will always only exacerbate the problem. This is not only pertaining to illegal drug laws, but also the government's chokehold on physicians and therapists. Politicians do not know more about addiction than doctors or therapists do. We should encourage blue ribbon panels to manage our drug management policies and establish support for harm reduction programs. That is the biggest immediate solution that we can do. We should have faith in the human condition and provide a second chance to people who are willing to take a chance at a second chance. We should set and enforce limits with those people. We should understand that most people do not want to be addicted, but we've created a system that prevents them from a second chance or getting the help that they need. We have a society where they have no sense of hope or future. We have to acknowledge the three categories of consumer, of user, misuser, and addicted person. We have to understand we can't make that stop. We need to understand that if we think only Big Pharma started this, well, then we're incarcerating addiction, which is a medical condition, just as if we would incarcerate diabetes or obesity. If we think that only thugs are using, then we're grossly unenlightened on this subject. When we hear people say we have to do something, ask what that something is. When our government says we'll give you more money to fight this problem, insist how will you fight this problem? What will you do with that money to make a remarkable, measurable difference? Enhancing law enforcement to create a drug-free society will not ever happen. Ever. That's a waste of resources. Countries that have had remarkable success in managing this issue have committed to criminal justice reinvestment. That is, money saved by not pursuing, convicting, and incarcerating users is diverted into programming, rehabilitation, and second chance opportunities. These successful social experiments began in 1996, over 22 years ago. So the science and the facts on success are in and irrefutable. Please know this, there is no panacea to ending addiction. We will always have to work to improve our management of this problem. We will never be able to control it. We need to get back to our primary mission in law enforcement. Only incarcerate people who are a threat to public safety and not jail people because of our societal confirmation bias or default pictures. Let's incarcerate people because it makes a difference and not simply because we're mad at them. Occasionally, after I reveal my position on this complex issue, some people say of me to others that I am pro-drug use because of my position. Anyone who tells you that I am pro-drug use is not paying attention. They're not enlightened on this topic, and I dare say they're doing a horrible disservice to justice and human rights in our community. Advocacy for drug policy reform and harm reduction is not advocacy for use. It is an approach of management over control, which is proven to have far greater success. Why did we begin our talk on this controversial topic with that of the flag bearer? The flag bearer ran headfirst into battle with the knowledge that they would be struck down defending the rights, the freedoms, and the care of those less fortunate. He was the marker on the battlefield for others to follow, which helped identify where the battle really was amongst the smoke and the confusion. He was a protector of the meek and died for the preservation and the dreams of those who had dared to dream. He did so to honor the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I ask you today to please join me in being a flag bearer. Help lead the way amongst the smoke and the confusion to keep hope, human rights, and freedom to persevere and overcome alive. I am not pro-drug use. I just think that facts matter and science matters. And I sincerely hope that the truth has a future. Thank you very much.